Hi, this is Alan Shartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Rabbi Israel Sy Dressner, an activist who was one of the original freedom riders of the early 1960s. He worked and walked alongside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to confront and oppose racism and segregation in the South. Later dubbed the most arrested rabbi in America, the outspoken rabbi participated in the June 13th or 16th Interfaith Freedom Ride from Washington, D.C. to Tallahassee, Florida. The son of a Brooklyn delicatessen owner, he graduated from the University of Chicago in 1950 and Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Theology. Rabbi Dressner continued his civil rights activism and advocacy throughout his career as a reformed Jewish rabbi in northern New Jersey, participating in the 1962 Albany campaign to desegregate municipal facilities, and in the 1965 Selma to Montgomery March. He retired in 1996. Welcome, Rabbi Dressner.
Thank you.
So tell me, what do you feel your obligation as a religious leader, as a rabbi is, rabbi being the word teacher, to your success in your career?
Well, I think my mission is to try to bring God's justice, God's peace, God's brotherhood, God's sisterhood to God's children, namely my fellow human beings.
And how do your congregants generally feel about this, or your former congregants now that you're retired? Did you ever have to use your pulpit to educate?
I did, and I tried through sermons, I tried through personal relations, but there were always people who were opposed to what I did, and we live in a free country, and they're entitled.
And how did that work out? I mean, can you give us an insight into what one of those conversations might be?
Well, I was never fired as some other rabbis were, so I was sort of lucky that way.
You didn't sleep late.
Excuse me?
You remember the series, The Rabbi Slept Late.
Yes.
And they were always trying to fire the guy. And he never got fired.
I read several of those volumes. Of course, I don't remember them exactly. But there were congregational meetings where people introduced resolutions to fire the rabbi. But I survived those congregational meetings. The Board of Trustees was frequently leery of my activities. But I survived those, too. And unfortunately, some people left the congregation because of my activities. On the other hand, several people joined the congregation because of my activities. So I think in terms of the net result, in terms of membership, it was probably more or less equal, but I'm probably prejudiced in saying that. I think those who opposed my activities would say we lost more members than we picked up.
Now, there have been accusations in the past of some anti-Semitism among minority communities towards Jewish population. There was a point at which you were most active, Selma, and doing this work, that some of the Jewish federations and others felt that they had been attacked unfairly. Do you remember those times?
I remember those times, and all I can say is that I never, ever, not once, met any anti-Semitism among the participants in the what was called the Civil Rights Movement or the Freedom Movement. From Dr. King on down, I only met welcome and hallelujahs.
Yeah, you'll remember when Jesse Jackson got caught off the record saying, Haimitam. What did you think at the time?
Well, it was an unfortunate remark. He should not have made it. It certainly could be interpreted as some Jews did in an anti-Semitic manner. Remember, it was reported by a black journalist.
Right.
And it was made privately. And all of us say things that we're later regretful for, including me. And I'm sure that Jesse Jackson apologized for it both privately and publicly. You remember his address at the Democratic National Convention in which he, you know, apologized for it. So that I didn't know Jesse Jackson very well because he was very, very young at the time of, you know, during the movement. And I was somewhat older. I was born at least 10 years, I think, before Jesse, 12 years before. And there's certainly no anti-Semitism in his public career. But it was an unfortunate remark, and it gave those in the Jewish community who were looking for a reason not to participate in civil rights activities a raison d'etre for not participating.
How did you first meet Martin Luther King?
I met Dr. King, actually, when he was in jail and I was outside. Dr. King, I had been arrested in a freedom ride in 1961. In 1962, Dr. King asked for clergy to come to Albany, Georgia, which was then the center of the movement. Every summer there was another city that was a center of the movement. In 63, it was Birmingham. In 64, it was St. Augustine, Florida. In 65, it was Selma, Alabama. In 62, it was Albany, Georgia, in the southwest portion of the state, about 300 miles south of Atlanta, closer to the Florida and to the Alabama borders, much closer than it was to Atlanta. And Dr. King issued a call, and two of us who had been arrested in the all-clergy freedom ride in which I was arrested in 1961, Ralph Lord Roy, a white Methodist minister who is still a friend, he's still alive and is still a friend of mine, the two of us responded, and we came down to Albany, and when we arrived there, we were taken by the local leaders of the movement there to the jail, because Dr. King had been incarcerated, I think, for the second or third time there. And he was in a cell with Ralph Abernathy. Ralph Abernathy was the vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of which Dr. King was the president and the founder. He was also a black Baptist minister like Dr. King. And I shook hands with Dr. King through the bars. I was visiting, and he was in. A funny incident happened, in fact, when that happened. As soon as he had shaken hands with us and we had said hello, he said, "Excuse me for a few seconds," and he walked over to the wall which separated his cell from the cell that was next to his. In the cell next to his, there were not two people the way they were in his cell, he and Dr. Ralph Abernathy, but there were about 10 or 12 young men who looked like college-age students in the next cell, and Dr. King knocked on the wall between the two cells, and the students immediately started singing a freedom song, and Dr. King came back to the bars and said to us, "I don't want the guards to hear what we're saying, and that's why I have this signal with the students. They sing and drown out what we're saying," kind of thing. And in those days, I didn't have any hearing problems. I'm wearing my hearing aids, but I wasn't 86 then as I am now. But that's how I first met him.
You went to yeshiva,
Yes.
I'm interested in, I'm always interested in parental influence. Obviously, you're a man who believes firmly in social justice. Did you get that from your parents?
Well, I attended the yeshiva, as it's pronounced in Israel. In America, it's yeshiva, the Yiddish way, through the ninth grade. So I didn't enter a public high school until the sophomore year of high school. My parents were both immigrants to America. My mother was brought here as a child of 7.5 years old, but my father was an adult of 21.5 years old when he came. My father had a marked Yiddish accent until he died. My mother had a straight New York accent. She was a New Yorker, you know. And they put me into the yeshiva, at enormous cost to them. They were spending 10% of their total income on my tuition, a great sacrifice on their part. And in the yeshiva, I learned the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, and I learned the teachings that Jews believe not only in one God, but believe in one humankind, since we're all descended from the same progenitor. That's the meaning of the religious meaning, the ethical meaning of the Adam and Eve myth. And so we better behave towards each other like brothers and sisters, since we are brothers and sisters. I learned how Moses had led the Jewish people of that time, the children of Israel, in a freedom struggle against Egyptian slavery. I learned that, obviously, from the Bible. And I learned the teachings of Moses, and I learned the teachings of the great prophets of Isaiah and Amos and Micah and Jeremiah. I learned Moses saying, "You shall not oppress nor wrong the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." I learned Moses saying, "The stranger that dwells among you shall be unto you as a homeborn among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." And the stranger, obviously, is the minority, as anyone who's different in house of worship from the majority, in skin pigmentation from the majority, in sexual orientation from the majority, in ethnicity from the majority, in language language from the majority, etc., and gender from the majority. So I learned all of those teachings, and that certainly had a profound influence on me.
So I heard you say something which was very interesting to me. You said the myth of Adam and Eve. Is that what you believe? Do you believe it's a story? Or, I mean, you
know. Well, there's no historical verification for that. We can't go back tens of thousands of years. We've never been successful in dating any specific individuals. We know that there were people, you know, there were Neanderthals, and then there were Homo sapiens and so forth and so on, but we don't know about individuals of that period. So, of course, in that sense, it's a myth. But myths are true if they have, you know, influence on groups for hundreds and thousands of years, as that myth has influenced Jews and Christians and Muslims for thousands and thousands of years.
However, you know, sorry for giving you a hard time, but I do remember that when you were talking about Moses, you didn't frame it as a myth. You framed Moses as having said this. So,
well, Moses is a lot longer after Adam and Eve kind of thing. So that
still a long time.
We have some historical basis for Moses is only 33 centuries ago. Even my Orthodox brethren don't claim that Adam and Eve are more than 5,775 years ago, but that's a lot longer. We don't have any writing in that period. The first cuneiform and the first hieroglyphics come about 5,200 years ago. So there can be no verification of that, but we know in terms of Moses that a Semitic group controlled Egypt for more than a century. They were known as the Hyksos. We know that they had overthrown the Egyptian dynasty, and then they were overthrown. We know that there was a group among the Hyksos known as the Hapiru, so that there is some general basis for the Moses legend.
So, Rabbi, and I hope you're not going to be offended, but I've interviewed many, many clergy over the years, and sooner or later in the interview, I get to that point where I ask them what I always define as an honesty question, meaning, you know, you got to tell the truth here. Do you believe in the concept of a God, a Jewish God?
Yes. Not only a Jewish God, a God of all humankind.
Right. But the God that you worship, let me see if I can get this right without infuriating everybody who's listening. But the God that you worship is the same God who looks over Christians.
Yes.
And how about those people who think that if in any way you disparage the concept of the Christian God, you go to hell?
Well, I disagree with them, and many, many Christians disagree with them.
That's terrific. Okay.
By the way, there are some Jews who believe that non-Jews, are not 100% kind of thing, and I disagree with those Jews.
Yeah. Well, you certainly make a point. So let me go back to your parents for a moment. What did they do for a living?
What did my parents do for a living?
Yes.
My father came here at the age of almost 22 after World War I. And he went to work for his older brother who had come before World War I, my Uncle Louis, who had founded a bar and grill on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. In those days, the Upper East Side of Manhattan was not a ritzy neighborhood the way it is today. There were two L lines in those days on 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue that rumbled along, etc. And it was called Dresner's. He established it in 1919, my uncle. And it's still there to this day, although it's been out of the family hands for a half a century or so. But it's still called Dresner's, and it's still on York Avenue between 78th and 79th Street. York Avenue is the most east avenue in Manhattan, right near the East River. In those days, it was a German neighborhood, a Hungarian neighborhood. There weren't very many Jews who lived in it, and my father went to work for his uncle, and he learned how to be a bartender, he learned how to be a chef, and eventually he got his own delicatessen in Brooklyn, where he was able to utilize the talents that he had learned from his older brother.
Did your mom work?
My mother was a homemaker, and neither of them had very much formal education. My father never went to any school after the age of bar mitzvah, the age of 13. He went to work in the old country at that age. He had only had a Jewish education before that, never a general education. My mother was brought here at the age of 7 and a half and attended public school in America. And she went through the first grade of high school, Washington Irving High School in Manhattan. And then she dropped out and went to work for Hurwitz, Margaretten, Matzes, since she knew the daughter of Margaretten, who attended school, public school with her. And so that they were not educated people.
So let me ask you this. You're 12 years older than I am.
You were born in 1941?
I was. And I do remember great cheering outside our apartment on 96th Street. And I remember asking my mother what was going on. And she said, well, a terrible man named Hitler has just been defeated. And that's probably my earliest sort of memory of the whole thing. What do you remember?
Well, I only gave you one reason why I participated in the freedom movement, namely the teachings of my faith. But a second reason is the experience of the people of which I happen to be a member, the Jewish people. We've been persecuted. We've been the butt of hatred, of bigotry, of bias, of discrimination, of segregation, of exclusion, of exploitation, of racism, et cetera, et cetera. So that I did mention the struggle of the Jewish people in Egypt at the very beginning of our history. But we've battled against that kind of thing ever since, and that certainly was a second precipitant of my involvement in the struggle for social justice, or for peace, etc. And there were other motivations. American idealism, the American dream, influenced me. When we read the Declaration of Independence every July 4th, and we read, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Certainly those ideals influenced me also, and not just Jewish teachings and not just the Jewish experience.
We're talking to Rabbi Israel Tsai Dresner, an activist who is one of the original Freedom Riders in the early 1960s. Let's put it this way. There are many people who are Jews who, when they saw what happened in the Holocaust, said, I can't believe in a God. How do you address that?
Number one, I understand their reaction, the reaction of those who reacted in that way, and I sympathize with them. And I when you lose your wife, your children, your father, your mother, and so forth, that's an enormous challenge to your religiosity. And I had members in my congregation in that category,
sure.
And they were quite open about it. We never had a loyalty test in the congregation. You didn't have to sign a document saying I'm a believer, and we had non-believers in the congregation just the way every congregation in America probably does.
So I want to go back to those years, the sort of Holocaust years. What were you?
I was not a kid anymore during the war. I was bar mitzvah in 1942. The war went on for more than 3.5 years after I was a bar mitzvah. So I have vivid memories of the war, although we did not know the extent of the Holocaust. That was kept a secret by the Germans. They didn't broadcast that they had a place called Auschwitz where they were murdering thousands of people, of Jews, every day. But we knew about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943, so that we had some knowledge, but not most knowledge. We didn't know the extent of it. We didn't know that 6 million Jews would be murdered, et cetera, et cetera.
Are you a Roosevelt fan?
A Franklin Roosevelt
yes.
fan, yes. He was the only president I knew as a child. I was almost 4 years old when he was inaugurated. He was inaugurated on March 4th, 1933. In those days, inauguration was not January 20th. It was March 4th. And I was 4 years old a month and a half later on April 22nd. And when he died, I was just 10 days shy of my 16th birthday. I would be 16 on April 22nd, 1945. He died on April 12th, 1945. So that he was the only president I knew, and I loved him and still have enormous respect for him.
Me too, by the way. But there are those people who say that he could have done more to help the Jews during the Holocaust years.
Well, the right wing in America, including right wing Jews, look for any possibility of finding something wrong with someone who was liberal. Was Roosevelt a saint? No, I don't believe there really are saints. The Bible makes clear that Moses was not a saint, that he made mistakes and that he was punished by God. But on the other hand, Roosevelt was the greatest president. Up until then, he was the 32nd president of the United States. And no president had ever appointed Jews to high office the way he did. Remember, the number two person in the cabinet, the Secretary of Treasury, and in those days, that was the number three person who became president if the president died. The vice president was first, the Secretary of State was second, and the Secretary of Treasury was third. They hadn't changed the rules to make the Speaker of the House third and the President Pro Tem of the Senate fourth. And for 11 of the 12 years that he was president, starting the second year in 1934, Henry Morgenthau was his Secretary of Treasury. Jews were appointed on every level to high office, including Felix Frankfurter, who was appointed to the Supreme Court. No other president had compared to Roosevelt. Roosevelt was the only Western democracy that broke diplomatic relations with Germany when that pulled its ambassador out of Berlin when Kristallnacht occurred before the Holocaust. That was before the war, November 9th, 10th, 1938, when hundreds of synagogues were burned and Jewish stores destroyed and Jews arrested and some killed. The American ambassador was pulled out of Berlin and he was criticized by the Republican Party for that. You know, we have lots of trade relations with Germany. We import a lot from them, and they import a lot from us. You can always find reasons, to disagree with somebody that you're politically opposed to, as if Roosevelt could have prevented the Holocaust. How could he have prevented it? They've never told us how. Was he supposed to personally go and kill Hitler or something? Or, in his wheelchair, he would do that. He's the one who saved Great Britain in 1940 when Britain stood on the verge of falling after the fall of France by becoming friends with Winston Churchill and sending the 50 destroyers and the destroyer for bases deal that he made. When he ran for re-election in 1940, the Republican Party denounced him as violating the Constitution. Where have we heard that before? More recently, England would never have survived without Roosevelt's help, and then sending them the arms and so forth that half the American population opposed. You got to remember, America was split between interventionists who believed that Hitler and the Nazi Germany had to be stopped, and isolationists who believed that we should, stay on this side of the Atlantic and not lift our left pinky to do anything. So that Roosevelt will go down in Jewish history as one of the great friends of the Jewish people.
You know, I'm struck by something you just said.
And I didn't even mention his wife, Eleanor.
No, indeed. Great hero. You just said something about Roosevelt and Great Britain. But I think less acknowledged, Rabbi Dresner, is the fact that he really helped to bring down British colonialism.
That's true also, yeah. And that included the Palestine Mandate, which became the State of Israel.
So when Roosevelt dies, Harry Truman becomes the president. Harry Truman is given great credit in the Jewish community for listening to his friend Jacobson, the haberdasher, his former partner, and standing up and creating the State of Israel, which you've just mentioned. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do. Like all things, history is not, a black and white kind of thing. It's mixed. And just the way Roosevelt had some bad traits, Truman had some bad traits. Truman's wife was a known anti-Semite. She would never allow a Jew into their home in Independence. And that included his haberdashery partner, a store partner, Jacobson, who never stepped foot in the Truman home. To the best of my knowledge, I've never, ever read a single anti-Semitic remark by Roosevelt. On the other hand, there are dozens of anti-Semitic remarks in Harry Truman, when he's speaking privately. Does that make Harry Truman an anti-Semite? No. We all have our failings, and we all don't live up to our ideals all the time. And Harry Truman will go down also as a great friend of the Jewish people, in my opinion, for granting not de jure, but de facto recognition to Israel within an hour after its proclamation of independence on May the 14th, 1948. So I have admiration for Harry Truman, but, you know, American historians do not rank Truman among the three greats. There are only three greats who are ranked by American historians, namely Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Washington, Franklin Roosevelt, not Teddy. Then there are seven near greats, and Truman is in the seven near greats, along with Teddy Roosevelt and Andrew Jackson and Woodrow Wilson and so forth. But all of them have imperfections, including Harry Truman.
As you know, after the Second World War, Secretary Morgenthau had the Morgenthau Plan, which was to make all of Germany into an agrarian society and not to ever let them have another factory or anything else again. I wonder whether you thought that was the right thing, would have been the right thing to do.
I don't want to offend you, but it was not after the war. It was during the war that he came up with the plan.
Right. And
it was in 1944. And I don't know that I knew very much about it at that time. I was 15 years old, and I don't know that I had an opinion, but in retrospect, I think it was a bad plan.
We're talking to Rabbi Israel Sy Dresner, an activist who was one of the original Freedom Riders in the early 1960s. Let's stay on Israel for a minute. There are those people, I am not one of them, who say that it's an apartheid state. How do you answer that?
Well, there are elements within Israeli society that are very, very right-wing. And I've been to Israel now. I don't have any money because, you know, clergymen don't make a lot of money. I've been to Israel 37 times in my lifetime. Since 1951, 1951, when I went to Israel to work on a kibbutz for a year, and I got drafted into the American Army at that time because the Korean War was on and I had to come back. I wasn't a rabbi then, and I served in the American Army for 2 years as an enlisted man. And I take a poll when I go to Israel. I can't rent the car anymore because I'm having sight problems with my eyes. I have macular degeneration, the normal things that happen to old people. And so I now take taxis when I'm in Israel. And I always take, and I speak Hebrew fluently. I raised my two children in Hebrew. I never spoke English to them from the day they were born until they went off to college.
Really?
Even when I hollered at them, and I did holler too much, but I never hit them. But I'm a hollerer, as you can tell from this interview. But take a poll of the taxi drivers. The last time I was in Israel was this past November, November 2014, and I was there for 2.5 weeks. And I took a poll of the 13 or 14 taxi drivers that I had been in. I always ask them the same questions. One of them is, what is the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem? And of the 14 that I interviewed this past year, this past November, 11 of the 14 taxi drivers. Now, these are not the most educated people in Israel, and they are not, you know, members of the Knesset or the parliament. They're not leaders as such. But 11 of the 14 said, kill all the Arabs. That's what happens to a society when it goes on in constant warfare kind of thing, and when it has a government whose leader preaches that kind of thing more subtly, namely its present prime minister, who will appeal to those terrible feelings that some Israelis have. He evidenced that on election morning, if you remember, on March 17th, when he said the Arabs are coming to the, he's talking about the Arab citizens of Israel, who are 20% of the population of Israel, 20% of the citizens of Israel are coming to the polls in droves, and they're being driven there by left-wing buses and so forth and so on. It was all BS. It was not true. The Arab turnout was much lower than the percentage-wise than the Jewish turnout. 74% of all the Jews voted. Only 63% of all the Israeli Arabs voted. But it was a way of appealing to the Jewish chauvinists, the Jewish racists, the Jewish, and there are those in every country. We Jews are not a perfect people any more than there is a perfect people anywhere in the world.
So I guess the next question is, since you did your poll, what is the right way for Israel to proceed right now?
The right way is a two-state solution. The right way is to stop building settlements in the portion of Israel, much of which will be returned to the Palestinians, namely the portion that was not part of Israel before the Six-Day War, and sit down and negotiate a peace treaty where Israel recognizes Palestine as a state and Palestine recognizes Israel as a state, and they sign a non-aggression pact, et cetera, not to make war on each other.
Well, Netanyahu says that's not possible.
Netanyahu says no matter what happens, he says that's not possible.
Yes, he does.
Prime Minister Rabin came close to that before he was murdered. Then Bibi Netanyahu, who was not prime minister yet, said exactly the same thing. And he denounced Rabin and Bibi's supporters had posters with Rabin, who had been one of the great generals in the Israeli War of Liberation, who was commander of all the armed forces during the Six-Day War. He denounced they had posters of Rabin in an SS uniform, a Nazi SS uniform. Can you imagine if a non-Jew did that to a prime minister of Israel? But it was never denounced by Netanyahu at that time, and he was the leader of the opposition party at that time, the Likud party, the party that's now in power. And he never, ever denounced any of those people who had those posters implying that Rabin was a Nazi and so forth and so on.
Rabbi, tell us about the first time you ever got arrested.
The first time I was arrested was a freedom ride in 1961. The first freedom ride left Washington, D.C. on May 4th, 1961. It was composed of white people and black people, and they almost killed several of the people on that freedom ride. I left on the 10th freedom ride, which left on June the 13th. Mine was the first all-clergy freedom ride, only Protestant ministers and rabbis. In those days, the Roman Catholic Church was not involved in the movement because there were lots of priests and nuns who were pro-movement, but the bishops at that time prohibited. It was before Vatican II, and they wouldn't allow their priests and nuns to go. The first time I ever saw priests and nuns was in Selma, which was 4 years later in 1965, after Pope John the 23rd and Vatican II had liberalized the Roman Catholic Church, as the present Pope Francis is liberalizing it now, after three predecessors who were very conservative. So that we were told that we were to try to integrate facilities all along the way. We left from Washington, D.C. on a regularly scheduled Greyhound bus. The first night we spent in Raleigh, North Carolina, since there were no hotels or motels that were integrated, we stayed at a black university that night, Shaw University in Raleigh. Whenever we stopped at a place, we were usually given a task by the movement to do something, and I was told that I was to meet a local black minister, and we were to try to integrate the bathroom at the airport. There's an airport that serves Raleigh and Durham. It's midway between the two. And the black minister picked me up in his car, and we drove to the airport. And they had notified the local newspaper at that time. I think it was called the Raleigh Courier Journal. I'm not sure. Or News Journal or something like that. It was headed by a very famous family, the Secretary of Navy in World War I, Daniels, Josephus Daniels, was the founder and editor of the paper for many years. Josephus Daniels' undersecretary during World War I was a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This was before he had he was felled by polio. His son was Jonathan Daniels became the press secretary for President Truman, and they were the editors of what was in the South considered a liberal newspaper by Southern standards. Everything is relative, as you know, and New York is not Mississippi. Obviously, what's liberal in New York is is considered radical in Mississippi, but what's liberal in Mississippi is considered moderate in New York. We went to the, they had notified the local newspaper, and we went there, and there was a photographer there with a flashbulb camera. And when we walked into the white bathroom together, the black minister and me, they took our picture, and when we walked out of the bathroom, they took our picture. They didn't go into the bathroom and flash our black and white penises kind of thing. But I'm told that it made the newspaper the next morning, but we left at 5 a.m. the next morning on a bus, and so I never, ever got hold of the newspaper. And we continued to try to integrate facilities along the way. There was resistance among the clergy. We were all scared. But we left Washington with 18 clergymen, 14 Protestant ministers, and four rabbis. All the rabbis were Reform rabbis. The Protestant ministers were nine white and five black. And we had elected a young black clergyman as our chairman in Washington. We didn't know each other, and we figured we wanted a black chairperson to negotiate along the way. And it turned out that a lot of the people, when we were trying to integrate a diner along the way, were, you know, just terrified. They were so scared and frightened. And I understand that, by the way, because I was scared. So finally, eight of the 18 went back north, and 10 of us, the 10 radicals, quote, stayed behind, eight ministers, five white, three black, and two Reform rabbis. The other Reform rabbi, unfortunately, is dead. And we were the first two rabbis arrested in the struggle. And we had been the first all-clergy freedom ride. We were arrested in Tallahassee, Florida, at the airport where we tried to integrate the restaurant. And they closed the restaurant in our faces when we tried to enter. We came back the next morning after sleeping at the homes of local black people in Tallahassee. Tallahassee is the capital of Florida. And I slept at the house of a Florida A&M professor. Florida A&M is the black university in Tallahassee.
But Tallahassee is Tallahassee.
This morning we tried to enter again, and they called the police, and the police arrested us.
Tallahassee, of course, for our listeners, was in those days, and to some degree still is, pork chop country. It's more Alabama than our concept of what Florida is, right?
Well, northern Florida is deep south. Southern Florida is sort of moderate north. The Nile River, you know, the upper Nile River is not in the north like the upper Mississippi River is. The upper Nile River is in the south because the Nile rises in the south and flows north. And the same thing with Florida. Northern Florida is like Georgia and Alabama, which it borders.
So
Tallahassee is there. Take a look at how close Tallahassee is to Florida and Alabama as compared to how close it is to Miami.
Right.
It's 400 miles from Miami, and it's 15 miles from the Georgia border.
So I guess I still haven't gotten quite the answer I want about the first time you were arrested and put into jail.
Well, I was rather pleased with the arrest because CORE was a civil rights organization, the Congress on Racial Equality, which sponsored the Freedom Rides, and they wanted us to get arrested because that would generate articles in newspapers, and there was a thing called newspapers in those days. And that's what we were supposed to do, was to get arrested. And particularly when 10 clergymen were arrested together, that made news. And one of the clergymen was famous. He had been on the front cover of Newsweek magazine. There were magazines in those days also. His name was Robert McAfee Brown, and he was a professor at Union Theological Seminary, which in those days was the greatest Protestant seminary in America. It's up near Columbia University and near the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was the oldest member of the group. He was 49 years old at the time. And that took a lot of guts on his part. And when we got arrested, one of my senators sent me a telegram in jail. I didn't know the senator. I'd never met him or shaken hands with him, and he was a Republican. In those days, there were liberal Republican senators. His name was Clifford P. Case. And today he would be considered a socialist, and by the Republican National Committee. But he was very pro civil rights, as was the senator from New York, Senator Jacob Javits, etc. And there were, I can mention a dozen Republicans of that time who were pro civil rights, not like today. Legislative assistants must have found out that one of his constituents had been arrested in Florida, and he sent me a telegram, and that was very helpful to me, because the telegram on the outside said from United States Senator Clifford P. Case, Washington, D.C., and it had to be delivered to me by one of the guards, and so they knew that I had some kind of protection. I thanked Senator Case when I came home. I didn't know him, but I met him after I came home and thanked him personally. There were all sorts of, as I repeat, things are not black and white. The Republican Party was not anti-civil rights in those days. There were anti-civil rights Republicans. There was Goldwater, et cetera, et cetera. But there were pro-civil rights Republican senators, like Senator Case.
But I want you to give the people a flavor of what it was like to be thrown into a cell.
Well, as I told you, I was scared, but everybody is scared of different things, and my scaredness was not as scared as the aide who left, basically. They were more scared than I was. When it comes to demonstrating against injustice, to demonstrating against bigotry, to demonstrating against racism, to demonstrating against violence, to demonstrating against warmongering, I've always been able to maintain most of my wits and figure what the probabilities are. Are you going to get killed? Are you going to get beaten? And so forth. And I was able to navigate that. And I was very proud of the 10 of us. We were, of course, segregated in jail. You know, the jails were segregated in those days. So the three blacks who were among the 10 who were arrested, the three black Protestant ministers, were separated from us. On their side, they were sort of heroes. On our side, the seven of us were outside agitators. In fact, they didn't have enough bunkers for us, and they gave us each a mattress. It was the thinnest mattress I'd ever slept on in my life. I think it had one side or something. My fellow rabbi who was arrested, who I told you is no longer among the living, Marty Friedman, was short. I was tall in those days. I hadn't shrunk as I've shrunk in my old age. He decided he didn't want to sleep on the floor, so he put his mattress on one of the metal tables that was screwed into the floor for eating. And in the middle of the night, he started yelling, and we all woke up, and his mattress was on fire. Apparently, one of the drunks who was in the jail came over with his cigarette lighter and lit his mattress. We put the flame out right away. But that was the kind of thing that happened in those days. But on the other hand, I'm scared of things that most people are not scared of. So I'm scared of most technological things, kind of thing. So I don't have an iPad. I don't want to go into it. My kids think I'm Neanderthal, you know.
One of the great heroes at Northeast Public Radio and a great friend of the station was always Pete Seeger, who has been instrumental in helping this station, Rabbi Dresner. Did you get to meet him in Selma and any of those places?
I never met Pete Seeger. I never had the play. I heard him sing, but I never met him. He was a great man, and he's also maligned because at one time in his lifetime he was sort of old left. I don't think he ever joined the party, but he was sort of a fellow traveler, and they hold those half dozen years or something against him, as opposed to the 70 years that followed.
Yeah.
But he's a great rescuer of your river there in Albany. You're in Albany, right?
Well, we're in Albany, but you're on the other side of that same river, aren't you, Rabbi?
Yes.
what do you mean, your river?
I'm not that far from the Hudson River, and Pete Seeger helped rescue that river.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So we have a film now about Selma, Alabama, and people who were there. Have you seen it?
I saw the film, and I thought it was a good film. But, you know, it's not a documentary. So it's not every historical event is not exactly accurate. The generality is accurate, you know. And there's one incident where I played a prominent role in Selma, which is not in the film. Did you see the film?
I did not.
Oh, you didn't? Well, Bloody Tuesday was March the 7th, 1965, in Selma, Alabama, when a group of several hundred SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, young people, tried to start a march from Montgomery to from Selma, Alabama, to the capital of Alabama, Montgomery. The governor of Alabama at that time was named George Wallace. And he turned out the National Guard, and they beat the people who were attempting to engage in a peaceful protest march. They hit them with billy clubs. They wore gas masks as they released tear gas at them. They charged them with horses, riding on horses. And John Lewis, who was today a congressman from Atlanta, Georgia, was almost killed at that time. And it's called Bloody Sunday. Dr. King was not there that day. He was in Atlanta, Georgia, at his father's church, preaching at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And that evening, the television was there, and that evening the country saw the segregated South was like in terms of governors and state legislatures and National Guards and so forth. And there was a great deal of sentiment in favor of the movement as opposed to opponents of the movement. And Dr. King issued a call for clergy to come to Selma and announce that he would start the march again on Tuesday, March the 9th, 2 days later. I flew down on March the 8th, on Monday, with three other clergy people from my area, another rabbi, a black minister and a white minister. The black minister was an AME minister, African Methodist Episcopal. The white minister was a Presbyterian minister. And we landed in Atlanta, and there was no way to get to Selma from Atlanta. So we rented a car, and we drove Monday night, Tuesday morning to Atlanta. I did the driving, and I've never driven so carefully in my entire life because the previous year in Mississippi, a mixed carload, three people, two whites and a black. We were three whites and a black in the car in Georgia, in Alabama, rather. Georgia and Alabama, the three were arrested by the sheriff, and they were later turned over to the Klan and murdered. They were Goodman, Schwerner, and who were the Jews, the two Jews, and Cheney, who was the young black. We were three whites and a black, so we were scared that we'd be stopped. I stopped at every stop sign, at every stoplight. I drove the speed limit. I didn't go 1 mile over the speed limit. And we made it to Selma, Alabama, and then made it to Brown Memorial Chapel about 5 a.m. in the morning. And we left with Dr. King at 8 a.m. in the morning when he started the march. I was up front, and when we got to, when we crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, there were the state troopers, in front of us, and Dr. King stopped all of us and asked everybody to kneel. We were now about 1,000 people, I think, or maybe more, because several hundred clergy had come down from the north. He asked two people to stand and each of them to deliver a prayer, one a Protestant and one a Jew. The Jew was me. If any of you saw the there's a history of the civil rights movement on a famous documentary called Eyes on the Prize. You can see the two of us standing and everybody else, including Dr. King, kneeling. In the film, they have everybody kneeling. Nobody is standing, and there's no prayer. And then after Ralph Abernathy delivered his prayer and I delivered my prayer, Dr. King turned us around and led us back to Brown Memorial Chapel. And that's why it's called Turnaround Tuesday. And some of the SNCC kids started denouncing Dr. King as an Uncle Tom, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason that Dr. King did it was on the Monday between Bloody Sunday and Turnaround Tuesday, SCLC had gone to the federal court asking for a court order to prevent the state from stopping a peaceful march. The First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees, you know, protest and for redress of grievances, if you remember. It's one of the five rights that are guaranteed in the First Amendment, along with freedom of religion, freedom of press, etc. And Dr. King said, we're convinced that we will get a favorable federal order allowing us to march and preventing the state from stopping us from marching. And sure enough, 8 days later, on March the 17th, the federal district court judge, Judge Johnson, and he was a very brave judge because he was a Southerner. He'd been appointed by Eisenhower. He issued a ruling saying that the state could not stop us. And Dr. King announced at that point that the march would start again on Sunday, March the 21st. I flew down, in fact, for the end of the march when they entered Montgomery. I flew down on March 25th when they entered Montgomery, and we had a big rally in front of the state capitol. I want you to know that on March the 21st, 1965, that was almost 189 years after the Declaration of Independence, the state capitol of Alabama still had a Confederate flag flying from its top. But I think our hour is up, and I want to say thank you to you.
Well, Rabbi Israel Cy Dresner, an activist who was one of the original Freedom Riders of the early 1960s. Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us. It was a terrific hour. I so enjoyed it. And we do appreciate
you. You're very welcome, and I thank you for the interview.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.